stories to you.
Hello, my name is Rosemary Milsom, and I'm the founding director of the Newcastle Writers Festival. In the pursuit of health, happiness, and youth, does anyone hold the secret? At this year's festival, Norman Swan discussed the ultimate dream, to stay as young as possible, for as long as possible. He spoke to Cassie McCullough about the science, myths, and mistruths that surround ageing.
Let's just try and summarise Norman Swan for a moment. Norman has many awards to his name. He's won a Gold Walkley. He's been awarded things by a range of organisations as diverse as the UN, the Skeptics of Australia. He's been on Four Corners. He's been on 730 Report, Catalyst. He has the health report, of course, and he kept us all sane and feeling safe with the CoronaCast podcast with Tegan Taylor. But last night, Norman and I were at a function and we were talking to this incredible young man. He was brilliant, but none of this meant anything to him until I said, and he was on The Biggest Loser.
Always something.
Yes. So he was a resident.
Which is the best fun I've ever had on television.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gee, I'd like to know what the worst one is.
I can show you that too.
So anyway, it is a great honour to be here with Norman talking about his book, which is all about living younger, longer. So, I mean, who isn't here to find out those two things? And also because everyone's a bit in love with Norman, let's be honest. Norman, I've got to start with your incredible passage to being where you are now. Starting in Glasgow, which is how you start this latest book of yours, and what you describe is, well, a pretty toxic environment for being healthy. Where we're born, what happens in those places is so important. Describe what was not in your favour health-wise as a young kid and young man in Glasgow.
Well, first of all, it was, well, not first of all, but there were many, many different factors. So Glasgow still has, I think, the highest coronary heart disease rate in the world. I think there are parts of India which are worse. Used to be parts of Finland which were worse, but Glasgow is still well up there. And there's a life expectancy gap between Glasgow and the rest of the UK. And there's a life expectancy gap within Glasgow. So the life expectancy gap within Glasgow, and this is not to diminish our totally unacceptable life expectancy gap between non-Indigenous and Indigenous Australians, was 25 years in Glasgow, between the longest lived suburb and the postcode and the shortest lived postcode. Now, as soon as you say that to people that, you know, Glasgow's like that, you say, oh, it's fried Mars bars.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
I've actually never seen a fried Mars bar, but I've seen fried haggis, fried white pudding, fried black pudding. And so who needs a fried Mars bar when you've got fried black pudding? Black pudding and chips, you know, just gets your mouth watering, doesn't it? But I mean, at home, growing up, parental smoking. So the air was thick. You went to family events. You could barely see who was across the room because of the smoking. Now, that was true in Australia to an extent as well. My mother had a chip pan on the cooker. I can't say stove any. I just got not used to saying stove, but all the time. So we would have had chips several times a week. I mean, and the notion of vegetables was really just about green mush occasionally. So the diet was totally appalling. And exercise was something that weird people did in dark gymnasia down dark lanes that you wouldn't want to go down. So it was just that sort of environment. And there were crossovers to Australia at that time. This wasn't unique to Glasgow. Now, the thing is that if you add all that up and say, why is there this life expectancy gap in Australia, in Glasgow compared to the rest? There's something that people call, you know, the Glasgow effect. So if you allow for bad diet, you allow for smoking and so on, Glasgow's not that different from, say, parts of Edinburgh, parts of Liverpool, Manchester, and other cities in Britain. But there's something different about Glasgow. So you take away the cholesterol, the smoking, and everything else, there's still an unexplained gap. And when you look at when that gap started to emerge, it started to emerge in the late 50s, early 60s in Glasgow. Now, Glasgow had the worst slums in Western Europe. I mean, that's the place where my grandparents arrived, or my great-grandparents arrived, off the borders, refugees from Ukraine, Lithuania, and so on. They arrived there, and then they worked hard and got out of it. But those slums were terrible places, terrible sanitation, and so on. The thing about Gorbals is the name of one of them that people might remember. They were very near the city centre, and the government knocked them down and put people out into government housing schemes on the periphery of Glasgow. And that's when the gap started to open up. And the explanation put forward, and there are other pieces of research which support it in other environments, is that what happened in the Gorbals, for example, is bad though it was a community. People knew each other. When kids were playing out the back, there was always somebody looking after them. Wasn't great, but it was a sense of community. When people got moved out into those housing schemes where there may be one shop, poor transport links, definitely a pub, there was dislocation and there was distress and despair. And people died of despair. Now, let's just come back to Australia. When you think of the life expectancy gap between First Nations peoples and non-Indigenous Australians, you tend to think it's because if you are an Aboriginal person, 65, your chances of getting to 85 are less than somebody who's non-Indigenous. Now, and that's the explanation for the gap. That is not the explanation for the gap. First of all, if you're a 65-year-old Aboriginal person, you've got a pretty good chance of getting to 85. But even if you die sooner, and this sounds very harsh to say it, you don't lose that many years of your life at that age. And life expectancy, and it's an important point for the rest of this discussion, life expectancy is an average. And that average hides all sorts of things. So coming to this point about life expectancy gap, if you're 65 and you get to 83 rather than 85, that doesn't really influence life expectancy as an average across the community. What does influence life expectancy is people dying in their young years and middle years. And the reason there's a life expectancy gap in Glasgow, it was in Glasgow and it still is, and in Aboriginal communities, is that people don't get the luxury of getting old. They die in youth and middle age of accidents, injuries, violence, alcohol, premature heart disease, diabetes, and so on. And so people are dying in middle age, and then you lose large numbers of years of life. And coming back to the distortion of that average is that a child born in an affluent suburb today in Australia, when life expectancy is 83 or 85, that child is going to live to 100. But they might not live to 100 if they're born into an Aboriginal community. So these distorts it. And what we're all talking about today is not life expectancy, it's lifespan. How long are we as individuals going to live in what sort of state?
Yes, and I think, well, I personally are very interested, but I think people are concerned about living longer, but not living well.
Exactly.
So I guess the focus for many of us is turning to how do we make sure that if we do have the luxury and the luck of living longer, how do we do it where we are not with chronic pain, where we can be active, where we have a great social community around us. Hopefully we're in proximity with our family and friends over a lifetime. And these are goals that sound very mundane, but that's it. That's life. That really is what we want.
Absolutely. Now, but we're already doing it without thinking about it, without really having thought about it too much. An 80-year-old today in Australia, their chances of dying in the next 12 months are the same as a 60-year-old's 50 years ago. I mean, that's how dramatic the change has been in two generations. How have we got there, which helps to explain, getting to, not a single person in this room wants to get, as you indicated, to a ripe old age, but you're frail and dependent. Nobody wants that. So what's got you to 80? Well, first of all, smoking rates are right down. We are amongst the world's
lowest smokers. They were.
Without vaping.
But, yeah, Big Tobacco's figured a way around all the amazing efforts that have been made over the years, and they're winning on that. They really are.
They are winning. And getting kids addicted to nicotine, and we don't know what those flavours and everything else in vaping are actually doing. But smoking itself is strongly pro-aging. It just gets... would it help if I explain why we age?
It would.
You know, what goes on? So there's, we don't know, the science does not know everything about this by any shape or imagination, but there are a couple of things we do know. One is the immune system's involved. So everybody now is an expert in the immune system because of COVID-19. So I'm going to quiz you on it now. Just put a multiple choice questionnaire. But there are three levels of the immune system. When you get attacked by an infection or something, your body sets up this artillery barrage. It's not directed, it's not targeted, they don't know what's coming in, but they just set up this, it just sets up this artillery barrage in the hope of stopping whatever's coming in while it learns, while it gets the intelligence about what is the attacker so that it can tell the antibodies, this is the attacker, go for that. And then there are cells sitting behind that which can then come in like tanks to clean up the infection. Now this barrage is called inflammation. And it's the same inflammation you get with a rash or with a wound, and it happens inside your body. You don't get coronary heart disease without inflammation. What happens, cholesterol gets into your arteries, the immune system gets involved, and then something else gets involved, which is oxygen. So we do a deal with the devil to live. We have to breathe in oxygen, but when oxygen gets inside your body, it rusts your body from the inside out. It's called oxidative stress. And so then oxygen gets involved with cholesterol. I'm just giving you an example of this because it's one of the processes of aging. So you've got inflammation, which causes scarring inside your body. You've got oxidative stress, which is internal rusting. And it basically slowly destroys your tissues from the inside out. And that's the aging process. And you can speed that up and you can slow that down. And there are certain things we know do that. Now, smoking speeds up inflammation and oxidative stress. Blood pressure, high blood pressure does the same thing. Cholesterol, if you've got diabetes and high levels of blood sugar, your diet and microbiome have an effect on all this as well. Exercise, we tend to think, well, exercise is good for your heart because your cardiovascular system. But exercise actually slows down a lot of these processes. So it's actually, and then what you want to do is not get mugged by stuff you could have avoided. So what I say in the book is, well, it used to be that people said, oh, if you want to get to a ripe old age in good shape, you've got to have parents who did so. So it used to be a genetic abnormality to get to 100. A nice genetic abnormality, but genetic abnormality nonetheless. And people were genetically young until quite older. Now it's a genetic abnormality to get to 110. But to get to 100, more and more people are getting to 100, not because of their genes, but because they haven't smoked or they've got their blood pressure under control or they're eating a good diet, which we can come back to later. What does actually that mean and so on? And you talked about the social environment. That counts too, and we should get back to that. And so we're getting there because of the environment which we've grown up. So if you're 80 years old today, you've probably had a couple of stents, you might have a new knee or a new hip, you've had your 50,000 mile service, but you're not in bad shape.
Well, yeah, hopefully. And yes, it has all kinds of implications for governments and families and facilities like, you know, whatever hopefully we transition to with a better aged care system.
It's not as much of a burden as politicians and treasuries like to make out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You get sick about 5 years before you die. So 5 years before you die 50 years ago was probably in your mid-60s or so. Now the 5 years before you die, particularly for a middle-class audience like this, is in your 90s. So it's that 5 years hasn't changed. It hasn't become 10 years. It's still about 5 years. The problem is the boomer generation, is that we've got this population bulge coming through. So there are more people going through that 5 years than there were before the boomers and then and after. So it's actually a population numbers phenomenon, not a problem of modern technology. And older people underutilize the healthcare system disproportionately, same as Aboriginal people do. So they're not heavy users if you take into account how sick they might be or how many diagnoses they've got.
I see. So it's the worried well, like myself, constantly.
Yeah, you're the problem, Cassie. Definitely.
off to the GP.
Well, if you look at Medicare, Medicare utilisation, and let's take Sydney, for example. Medicare utilisation in Vaucluse, the eastern suburbs of Sydney, or the northern suburbs of Sydney, are much, much higher per capita than in an Aboriginal community. Much higher.
But that, you could argue, is simply because of the availability of the services. Is that,
correct.
Is that all it is?
That's, no, it's not all it is, but that's right. So doctors tend to focus on, there's not, well, people say there's a problem, but there are far fewer problems finding a doctor in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, the western suburbs of Perth, the northern suburbs of Adelaide, than there is in other parts.
Yeah, I see. Okay, well, we are going to talk about diet, because I'm sure you're aware that Chris Martin from Coldplay's just announced his new diet, which is actually Bruce Springsteen's, and I want to know if you approve of it. We'll get to that. But
Does that allow for the exercise that Bruce gets on the stage?
Well, I think he's in pretty good shape, just quietly. But you know, look, okay, well, let's talk about it. So Chris Martin has announced that he is only having one meal a day, and this has to take place before 4 p.m.
He must be a lot of fun.
Well, he was married to Gwyneth Paltrow, so I think that speaks for itself.
Anything's fun after that.
Oh, yes. I think we've all consciously uncoupled from that. But anyway, apparently you have just black coffee, black tea, no meal, nothing really, and then you get this meal that has to happen before 4, and that's it. And this is keeping the boss alive, and now it's going to keep Chris alive too. What do you think?
Can I go back a little bit? Because these are people who are incredibly wealthy and have got a lot of resources. And we jump to the particular too quickly. So let me pull back, and I will get to your answer about the one meal a day, because that's what David Sinclair does, and some people here would have read David Sinclair's books on staying longer. He believes in resveratrol and metformin, and we can get to that supplement stuff later. One of the most important things, and I talk about it a lot in the book, to never forget, is that your brain runs everything. Your brain runs everything. So we've got a conscious brain where we can decide that we're going to take one meal a day and we can decide that we're going to have some exercise. But there's the unconscious brain as well, which monitors our environment all the time. But it's not, it monitors it for threats, temperature, our social relationships, everything. And then when things go wrong in our environment, the unconscious brain only knows one thing to do, and that's to give instructions unconsciously, beyond your conscious level, to the rest of the body. Now, if you are, let me just get another concept in, which for those of you who've done psychology, you know, feel me in psychology 101, but it's called locus of control.
Locus of control.
Locus of control. Simply put, where do I feel that my life is controlled? If it's here, it's pretty good. If I feel I control my, I can make decisions about my own life, I'm in control, locus of control here, that's a healthy place to be. If you've got a lousy boss and a lousy job, it's over here with that lousy boss and that lousy job. If you're a single parent with 3 kids on a pension, it's over there. You don't have locus of control. If you're in an Aboriginal community where a stolen generation and your cultural your heredity and your ownership of the land is not recognized, it's over here. That's what the voice is about, by the way. The voice is about community locus of control coming back here. Voice is about health and well-being as much as it is about politics. But anyway, the what, do you realize I've just broken the ABC's code of conduct here? Just
on the record, I wasn't seen to be clapping, all right?
So when, for example, you are lonely, or you've lost this locus of control and it's somewhere else, and things are not going well in your life, your body, your brain picks that up. It doesn't understand it, but it says something's going on here and perceives it as a threat. In the same way, similar way to it perceives a threat which might be an acute threat, like in warfare or so on, and your body goes on alert. So it says to the rest of the system, I don't know what the hell's going on here, but it's not good, let's get ready. So it says to the immune system, to the artillery barrage, get ready, something's coming. So the inflammation levels go up. Body metabolism goes up, blood pressure goes up, pulse rate goes up, your stress hormones go up, which make you more susceptible to diabetes. But what's a situation that's normally for a few hours lasts for weeks and years. No. And that promotes aging.
I'm not sure if anyone here was able to get to the opening night address with Grace Tame. Did anyone manage to be there? And hearing her talk about the trauma of her life and the stress that she lives with and the daily, hourly, by the minute control she has to exert over herself, it's evident that that takes a toll on your...
Huge.
Obviously mental health, but your physical health. And then from there, probably even, not in her case, because she's an incredibly successful, brilliant person, and rightly we celebrated her by being giving her the honour of being Australian of the Year. But that can flow onto your relationships and your social well-being as well.
And your physical well-being. So here's how it can multiply. So you're getting on a bit in years, you've lost your partner, you're starting to lose your friends, and you're feeling lonely. So that your body picks that up and says, this is not good, and puts the body on alert. So already your physical aging is starting to speed up just because of your social environment. And then you say, oh, I can't be bothered cooking tonight. I'm just going to have a cheese sandwich. And then the monotony of your diet affects your microbiome. So instead of your microbiome being diverse and youthful, it actually starts to be pro-aging as well, and you get this cascade. So coming back to...
Chris Martin and Bruce Springsteen. And they're not making cheese sandwiches for themselves, are they?
No, and they've got lots of hangers-on around making them feel good and so on. But there is something to the one meal a day. But one, again, has just got to factor in a little bit of... So the one thing we know that slows down aging metabolically is having a calorie gap in your life. And eating one meal a day, it doesn't really matter when it is, creates a bit of a calorie gap in your life, and it creates a bit of metabolic stress. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to do, but it's got to, what you eat in that one meal is incredibly important. Let me talk about the second, you and I have spoken about this before, the second longest lived people in the world. Do you remember this? No.
It's either the Japanese or the Italians, is that right?
No, the Japanese are the longest lived. The second longest lived people in the world are elderly Greek Australians living in Melbourne.
Oh, really?
Wow. And it's probably true of elderly Greek Australians living in Newcastle as well. But they've been best studied in Melbourne by Tanya Throdis and Catherine Itsiopoulos at Deakin University. So what are the and if you look at an elderly Greek Australian, they don't look that well. You know, they've got a fat tummy sometimes if they're men. They may have diabetes and heart disease, but they live about 6 years longer than the average Australian. So they do live a long time. So what is it? So as soon as I say
olive oil,
that's exactly what people come to. So it's the Mediterranean diet. So I dissect the Mediterranean diet in this book. You've got to be careful with the Mediterranean diet, because if you go to Italy, you're stuffing your face with mortadella and prosciutto, which I love, but it's not a recipe for a younger, longer life. It's so the Mediterranean diet is actually different in different parts of the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean diet that's been best studied internationally for longest is actually the diet of the Greek islands. And yeah, well, that's right. So even thinking about the Greek islands gets your inflammation down, oxidative stress down. You know, let's all just go to the Greek islands for a moment. So. What is it? Now, you know the story about the Mediterranean diet. Meat once a week, not very much meat. Protein from chickpeas, lentils, legumes, or fish, maybe a little bit of poultry. Big variety of vegetables, not much fruit. But just describing it like that does not tell you the whole story, because it's what counts as much as that is cuisine, how you cook it. And by the way, the Vietnamese diet is not that much different from the Mediterranean diet. It looks different and it tastes different, but the elements are quite the same, and cooking is actually quite similar. So it's cuisine. So if you're eating an ultra-processed supermarket-bought diet, and it's, which is really unhealthy, and you decide, I'm just going to eat raw food from now on, that's great, much, much better for you. But if you decide you're going to cook that food, then that's when the magic really begins. So a raw tomato is good for you. A chopped tomato is even better because it starts to release the good stuff inside the tomato. Pour some extra virgin olive oil on it, more gets released. But when you heat that tomato with extra virgin olive oil, it releases incredibly potent bioactive compounds that are actually pro-youth. They slow down aging. So when you do the basis of, well, really a lot of Mediterranean food to be fair, extra virgin olive oil in the pot, moderate heat, onions, garlic, tomatoes, carrots, and whatever else you want to put in, that cooks up these bioactive compounds. The other thing with early Greek Australians is they've got a backyard or an allotment. Remember, it's Melbourne. They grow their own vegetables and herbs. Freshness is much more important than organic. So whatever is in those herbs and vegetables, we'll never know all of that, goes into the pot and they get maximum utilization of it. And they cook moderately because the burnt stuff on food, which we all love, that caramelization, is pro-aging. And that's rarely done in the Greek. I know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then they eat with family and friends. Mm. So a member of the brain runs everything. And here's the final thing. They belong to the Greek Orthodox Church.
Okay, I wasn't expecting that. What's happening there that we need to emulate if we're not in it?
100 fast days a year.
Oh.
But they're not Michael Mosley fasts.
Right.
They're days of frugality. So you don't eat animal protein. So you eat vegetables for a day, maybe doused in olive oil. And this goes along with current research. Now, what happens with the fasting type diets, and even the one day a week, the one day a meal thing we were talking about with the boss, is that your body adjusts very quickly to any stress that it's put under. So if you create a big calorie gap, your body says, oh, I don't like this idea. And your body starts burning fewer calories when you're at rest. And then the calorie gap gets less. But if you do intermittent frugality, the body never really finds out about it to that extent that it adjusts. And so you get a bit of a calorie gap and it stays there with you over a period of time. And then when you're eating incredibly healthy food. So that when you, what more recent research from the University of Sydney has shown is that if what you do is a 5-2 diet sort of thing or a 16-8 diet, you will lose weight, but your metabolic profile may not improve. Mm-hmm. And the people in whom the metabolic profile improves are the people who pay attention to what they eat when they're allowed to eat. So if it's a lot of vegetables, well-cooked in the Mediterranean style, then you get the benefit.
I'm taking all this on board, but I'm just going to acknowledge the voice in the back of my head that says, yeah, but, you know, it's easy for skinny people and we live in such a world of plenty. No humans on earth have ever had such opportunity to access calories as we have. So in the back of my mind, I'm also hearing my voice going, yeah, but if I had a lifestyle like Chris Martin, that would all be fine. So I just want to acknowledge for everyone else who might feel like me, that it's hard to do all this. It's hard to cook fresh vegetables. It's hard to create this when you're trying to pay a mortgage and keep three jobs down and all that. So anyway, I just want to put that there.
Yeah, I've spent a life trying to get, you know, a six pack.
Well, you look pretty good,
instead
Norman.
Instead of my Pinot Noir. And,
oh, well.
It's very hard.
Now, okay, I'm going to hit you with some rapid-fire questions. So what are the drugs that are either becoming available or available now that actually make you quite excited about health if they're used responsibly?
So we're not talking about cocaine. Or, we're talking about legitimate drugs. So
no, anything not with that.
And cocaine is not one of them. Stuff that's already around. So let me just say, what we've been describing is incredibly potent in terms of living younger, longer. Drugs add on to this. Because the other reason that people are living to 80 in good shape is what GPs do. So GPs have got much better at detecting blood pressure, high cholesterol, and so on, and treating it. So blood pressure lowering drugs, cholesterol lowering drugs, have saved more lives than almost any other drug. So we spend literally billions of dollars on anti-cancer drugs, these new anti-cancer drugs, for the net effect of 2 or 3 months of, on average, of survival. Some people it's dramatic and their cancer is cured, but overall we're spending billions of dollars for a few months survival. Blood pressure lowering, cholesterol lowering is gaining us many years in really good shape.
Okay, so they're the ones we have. What about the ones on the horizon, do you think?
Well, we are, I'm not a technophobe about this, but are we going to get to a point where we treat dementia and we've got drugs that actually keep our brain health in good shape? That's going to make an enormous difference. The problem at the moment is that because of territorialism and male egos in the dementia research space, we've been following the wrong line in dementia research, probably wasted billions of dollars on the wrong target in the brain. But luckily, there are other people looking at other targets in the brain, and we may well get to the point in our lifetime where we actually can intervene significantly to make a big difference. But we already know that if you exercise, if you lower your cholesterol, lower your blood pressure, it's all boring stuff, your brain health will improve and improve significantly. And if you exercise your brain itself with challenging tasks, you will actually also improve. Cancer treatment is getting better all the time, and we will get to the point where we will get far more effective cancer treatments, which will extend people's individual lives. But it still won't match stopping smoking, watching your diet, watching your alcohol intake, and getting cancer screening. Here's an inexplicable fact. 60% of Australians would rather die than do the poo test when they're 50 years old. I don't get this. 40%, only 40% of Australians will do the poo test, which is life-saving. Mm. Get it done.
Yeah. Norman, of course, is also the face of the government's bowel cancer testing regime. And I've spoken about this on the radio, and I'll never forget the woman who rang up and said that her brother had died quite young of bowel cancer. And when she was cleaning out his home, she found all these tests that had been sent to the house that were in a drawer unused. So don't let that be
It's
you.
Only poo. And most of you have changed your kids' nappies, so get on with it.
Yeah. Okay, so what about exercise? There was this brilliant man talking on Radio National's Life Matters program earlier this week about exercise. Now, he was American, and so maybe he'd taken it a little bit too far. He was doing 14 hours a week, and which is admirable, but I'm not going to be following that anytime soon. But what he did say is 3 hours a week is an enormous improvement on nothing. Like, if you can just get 3 hours a week in, then on top of that, maybe the returns aren't there quite as much, but it gets better and better. He said respiratory health is unbelievably important, but particularly, he said, for older people, strength training, he believes, is absolutely key. And he used a word, and I'm sure you'd know it, but it horrified me. It started with S, but it describes...
Sarcopenia.
He described it as somebody who had no muscle mass left, so they were pretty much like blobs. And as I was sitting there at my, you know, kitchen table listening, I was like, oh, you know, I don't want that.
Dropping away from me.
Yeah.
He's right. I mean, we should be doing 45 minutes to an hour most days of the week. You should be working hard at it, which means if you've never done it before, walking along the flat, and getting to the point where you're breathless enough that you can't gossip about the kids or your friends. If you can, you're not working hard.
Or your colleagues.
Or your colleagues, that's right. We gossip about our colleagues. After a couple of weeks, when you actually find you're starting to able to gossip, you've actually got to work harder at it. So do the same distance in less time or start putting heels in. You've actually got to progress steadily so that's harder and harder and harder. If you haven't got the time, then HIIT is really good for you, which is high-intensity interval training. Now, that sounds like something you'd have to do in the gym, but in fact, you can do it when you're walking, which is, if you haven't got 45 minutes, but if you do even 7 minutes where you, and again, this depends on your general health and well-being, you want to be sure that your heart's okay and so on, is that you walk as fast as you can or run as fast as you can for maybe 20, 30 seconds, and then you stop and just walk slowly, and then you do that again, and you're just constantly pushing, relaxing, that you can actually compress that for the cardiovascular effects of that into a shorter space of time. Strength training along with that is incredibly important, because one of the causes of frailty, going back to the start of our conversation, we don't want to be frail, is that you've got to have strong muscles. So strength training of some kind has got to be part of your daily routine, not just for being able to get out of the chair and walk and do all the things you want to do, but muscle is a highly metabolically active tissue and metabolizes sugar and metabolizes and uses your insulin levels. And if you've not got a strong muscle mass, you're more susceptible to diabetes. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, absolutely right. And if you're doing 45 minutes to an hour, the incremental effect of doing even more than that is not high. But if you can jog, so doing weight-bearing exercise and jogging is a particularly good exercise. And what happens is it starts to clear out the rubbish that accumulates inside your body as you age.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Very soon I'm going to throw this open to you. There will be people who have microphones, so get ready to shoot your hand up. My other curious thing that's been on my mind is about things to avoid and things that are absolutely useless. Now, I know that once I nearly fell over listening to you on the radio because you said vitamins just give you very expensive wee. And, as someone who, like many Australians, have a whole shelf in the bathroom devoted to vitamins and supplements and this, that are probably mostly past their use-by date because they're so awful and boring to take. So I know you, unless you have a very good reason to be taking those, they're on your don't be bothered with list.
Yep.
What else? What else should we not bother with? Plastic surgery? Botox?
Well, funny you should say that. The there's a thing, one of the things I deal with in the book is, if you look young on the outside, are you young on the inside? And having had work done, it's cheating in this one. And in fact, you probably are younger on the inside. And it's partly because sunlight, the aging effect of sunlight in your skin, that aging effect also causes your immune system to be more inflammatory and probably damages you internally.
Yes, I read this in your book. So the cells that have been exposed to the sun take that message back inside the body and tell
the immune system, and it starts to react.
Yeah, right.
That's right. Having work done, by the way, is not necessarily a bad thing if it makes you feel good and re-socializes you. Feeling good is not a bad thing to feel if you can afford to have it done. Just don't look like everybody else. So you're talking about things that avoid it. So there are almost, you're right, there are almost no vitamins that will help you live younger longer. And there's an important thing to understand why. Part of it's about dose. You tend to think that when a little bit is good for you, more must be better for you. And it doesn't work like that with biological compounds. They can behave in a very different way at a high dose than they do at a low dose. This is not side effects, it just influences your body. So vitamin C at a low dose in food is antioxidant, lowers inflammation, anti-aging. Mm. Vitamin C as a supplement in high dose is probably pro-aging because it behaves in a different way in your body. And there are no vitamins at all that really... Now, there are some people who need vitamin D because of racial or genetic reasons and what have you, but that's the story with vitamins. Then there's a whole series of supplements that should work, but for some reason they don't. When I say they should work, when you give them to mice, The mice live 20 or 30% longer. They're usually genetically selected mice in good health. But when we take them, they don't seem to work. And these are things like resveratrol, quercetin, there's a drug called metformin, and they don't seem to work. Metformin may work, but the others don't seem to work when they should work. And this is probably dose as well. And what I describe, what I often talk about here is imagine the Tower of Pisa when it's freshly built, straight up and down. And instead of it being the Tower of Pisa, imagine that's the balance in our body. There's a balance in our body. If our blood pressure goes up, there's a system to bring it down. If our inflammation goes up, there's a system to bring it down. So everything's nicely in balance. And then as we age, it's just inevitable that it just starts to tilt towards aging. Now, if you've had a lot of smoking or stress in your life, you'll tilt faster and so on. Now, what these supplements trying to do is nudge you back to the vertical. But what happens is the body gets used to the tilt. And when you give a high dose of, say, an NAD booster or an NMN booster, which is one of these supplements, the body says, piss off. You're trying to push me to somewhere I don't want to go, and it fights back. Uh-huh. So it may well be that at some point, these substances that should work maybe will work in combination in tiny doses once a fortnight, where the body just never gets used to it and you slowly get back. But we don't know that yet. But the other things to avoid are just being sensible about your diet, not going on a monotonous diet with one thing. And if it sounds mad or sounds too good to be true, it will be mad or too good to be true. So alcohol, for example, there's no safe dose or good dose of alcohol that's going to keep you younger longer. But if a small amount of alcohol helps to lubricate social events and seeing friends, that is going to be a huge net benefit to you. And it's going to do you minimal harm as long as you're not...
Yeah, I've always been suspicious of those wine is good for you studies that come out from the south of France, you know.
Yeah.
It is too good to be true. Okay, on that cheery note. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank wonderful Norman Swan.
I hope you enjoyed this session, which was recorded at the 2023 festival. Save the date for next year's event, which is going to be held from April 5 to 7. Special mention to Create New South Wales, who have supported this podcast series.
Stories to you.